evening. In the news tonight, U.S.-backed Iraqi government troops and Kurdish fighters launched an operation to retake Mosul. Peace activists want the U.S. to stop spending money on military operations around the world. Planned Parenthood, which began in New York City, is 100 years old. And Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman won't face a riot charge from her coverage of a protest against construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Monday, October 17, 2016. The U.S.-backed government of Iraq launched a campaign today to take Mosul back from Daesh, from IS. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi appeared on state TV flanked by armed forces top commanders.
My dear people, dear sons of Mosul, the hour of victory has come. The operation to liberate Mosul has started. Today I declare the start of the heroic operations to liberate you from Daesh, the Islamic State group.
Mosul is Iraq's second largest city and the last urban center still under control of Daesh in Iraq. U.S.-led airstrikes and heavy artillery pounded the city. The bid to take Mosul comes after the military, backed by armed tribes, militia, and U.S.-led coalition airstrikes regained much of the territory the fighters seized in 2014 and 2015. The International Rescue Committee, a relief organization, has warned that thousands in the Iraqi city of Mosul are at risk of getting caught up in the military operations, that there is a lack of clear escape routes. The group said up to 1 million people in total could flee their homes in search of safety, that 200,000 are likely to flee the city in these first weeks of the operation, but only 60,000 tents are available in seven emergency camps. Stefan Dujarric is spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
Well, we hope that that it will bring solace to the people who've been trapped by Daesh in the area. We also remind all the parties concerned of the need to respect human rights and international humanitarian law in the fight against Daesh.
According to the UN, the ongoing fighting between Iraqi forces and Daesh has displaced more than 3 million Iraqis and left an estimated 10 million in need of humanitarian assistance. Peace activists want the U.S. to stop spending money on military operations around the world. They say Iraq is one of the places the U.S. should never have been. Ruth Benton is with War Resisters League and National War Tax Resistance. She says, pay attention.
People's tax money is going into all this military weaponry and these endless wars, and young people are growing up with this. It's like in the background these days. They hardly even talk about it in politics or on the media. So just to do something, be out here, have a vigil, get some leaflets around, talk about it, bring it up to candidates about how are we going to end these wars. I mean, we just have to bring these troops home and get out and use the money for all these other needs that people have here.
And what about the war machine? What about weapons going to Israel? Weapons
weapons
being
going
sold
everywhere,
to Saudi
Arabia. Absolutely.
Yes.
I think that, to me, that is like one of the key issues. The U.S. needs to get out of the arms business. We're number one. And all of these different groups, especially in the Middle East, who are getting guns, a lot of them are U.S. guns that they've picked up from other places, or they're buying from the black market or wherever they're getting them from. They're U.S. guns, and we just have to get out of the out of the arms business. That's a key to ending all of this, to ending war.
Media Leaf is with the Granny Peace Brigade. She says with the U.S. involved in at least seven wars, there's no sign of stopping. It just seems to go on and on.
With no consideration for the costs, human, financial, emotional, it's going on and on. And there is, peace is a human right. We must work as hard for peace as we are for war. Look what it's doing to the environment, to the infrastructure of those countries. And wars just destroy the whole fabric of a society because it impacts women and children the hardest.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. in campaign news Sunday saw the ninth release of Hillary Clinton's campaign chief John Podesta's emails by WikiLeaks. This brings the total number of leaked Podesta files to over 12,000. The emails speak to Clinton's cozy relationship with mainstream media and how the campaign works closely to control the media landscape and sets up stories showing her in a favorable light. WikiLeaks has not released any emails from the Trump campaign. This fuels accusations that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are trying to influence the U.S. election in Trump's favor. WikiLeaks tweeted this morning that Julian Assange's internet connection has been intentionally severed by a quote-unquote state party. It noted that it has activated the appropriate contingency plans to get WikiLeaks back up and running. Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks. He's been living in Ecuador's embassy in London for more than 4 years, this in an attempt to avoid extradition for potential espionage charges. Meanwhile, as the Trump campaign continues to implode, Donald Trump is trying to undermine the legitimacy of the U.S. presidential election process. He's pressing unsubstantiated claims that the contest is rigged against him, that the many women who have come forward to attest to improper advances by Trump are untrue.
It's a rigged system. And they take these lies and they put them on front pages. This is a rigged system, folks. But we're not going to let it happen. We're not going to let it happen.
In New York, elected officials along with the National Organization for Women gathered in front of Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue to stand for the women who came forward accusing Trump of sexual misconduct. Terry O'Neill is president of NOW.
We will not tolerate his talk about sexually assaulting women. We will not tolerate his talk insulting women and demeaning women. We will not tolerate him as president of the United States. We will elect him.
Those gathered say electing Donald Trump would set women back decades. Meanwhile, many of the elected officials gathered this morning were together last night at City Hall in celebration of the 100th anniversary of Planned Parenthood. New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Vivodito.
Being here today, we are basically saying that women's reproductive health is non-negotiable. We will not allow our bodies to be used as political pawns. We will not be shamed, right, into silence. And in this political climate, that is clearly what some are attempting to do. So we have made progress. We're talking about certain issues more publicly than we had in the past. But obviously, the work is not done.
Mark Vivodito points to Planned Parenthood's long history addressing women's needs in New York.
Planned Parenthood has always strived to provide services to all women in need and focused many of their efforts on immigrant women in New York City. So in particular, their Promotoras de Salud program trains neighborhood residents to serve as peer health educators and advocates for their communities. And the program has increased access to sexual and reproductive health for Latinas in the city of New York, and I'm really proud of that work. The Young Women's Initiative, funded by the New York City Council, is another one of Planned Parenthood's efforts to provide women with contraceptive services and education. They're going to be one of our partners in that initiative. So my colleagues and I on the New York City Council have always believed in Planned Parenthood and their various programs. And as a daughter of a feminist, raised in Puerto Rico in the 1970s, someone who was there in the front lines with my mother as she struggled to provide greater access to services for women, I thank Planned Parenthood for what they do.
Planned Parenthood began in 1916 in Brooklyn, in Brownsville. That's where Margaret Sanger opened the nation's first birth control clinic. Sanger saw women's lives stunted and unfulfilled, and she saw enough and said enough. She opened a storefront for women to get information about avoiding pregnancy. New York State Assembly member Latrice Walker represents Brownsville.
This is the neighborhood of Maya Lansky. This was the neighborhood of Lucky Luciano. And I want you to understand that they come from a street gang called the Amboy Street Gang, right? So this is the atmosphere that she was opening up this clinic in. It wasn't a safe place for her. It wasn't just that it was unsafe for her because her actions were illegal, and she had to worry about the threat of the police department. This was also one of the most notoriously dangerous blocks within the community that this clinic existed. But today, it brings me great joy to not only stand here amongst my leaders, my mentors, many of my colleagues who are here today, to speak of the wonders of Planned Parenthood. But this has also happened in the face where just recently in the New York State Assembly, one of my colleagues indicated that the most dangerous place for a black child is in their mother's womb. And this came as we were voting on and debating reproductive health care rights in our state. It was at that time that I made a courageous statement. And that statement allowed people to understand that as a high school student, I would sit in class with other high school students and we would talk about sex because that was the only outlet that we had, each other. And if there was ever any serious question that any of us had, that question was answered on Court Street, right? At Planned Parenthood. And this was the only place that we can get any solace. It even went so far as we were too afraid to go home and talk about these issues to our own parents. So they used to have this thing, I don't know if they still do it now, but they would send the envelope home if they had to mail you something in an envelope that it might just have a star on it. Thank God for that star. Because my mom would have killed me if she knew where I had been. But it gave us an outlet. And then also at a very young age, I had an unintended pregnancy. And I made a decision at that moment because I said, you know what? This is our bodies, ourselves, our choice, and that ability to make that choice exists even for me. And I made that choice and I had an abortion. I didn't become a zombie. Right? There was nothing crazy that happened. It didn't take away my ability to be able to reproduce in the future.
Walker stands with her four-year-old at her side in the City Hall Rotunda. Cecile Richards is president of Planned Parenthood.
It's incredibly humbling to be here and think about that 100 years ago today, in the neighborhood, Brownsville neighborhood of Brooklyn, a nurse named Margaret Sanger, her sister Ethel, and their activist friend, Fanya Mandel, opened the first ever birth control clinic. It was a storefront where if you had 10 cents, you could get a pamphlet about how to prevent pregnancy. And of course, it was 100% illegal. And from day one, and we have, of course, the old pictures, and some of them are probably shown today, you see women were lined up down the block, pushing baby strollers with babies on their shoulders in these long dresses, desperate to figure out how to prevent another pregnancy. 10 days later, an undercover cop posing as a mother busted Margaret, threw her in jail, where she taught all of her fellow inmates about how to prevent unintended pregnancy, and our movement began. And that's sort of the fighting spirit we've tried to carry forward ever since. So over the last 100 years, Planned Parenthood grew from that one storefront clinic to more than 600 health centers all across the country, and we are in every single state in America. And each year, more than 2 million patients pass through our doors, thousands in New York alone. And 1 in 5 women in this country have come to Planned Parenthood for healthcare at some point in their lifetime. So, exactly. The great alumni of Planned Parenthood patients numbers in the tens of millions in America. And the exciting thing is, of course, that along the way, life for women in this country changed.
Cecile Richards says Planned Parenthood's first 100 years changed what's possible for women. In the second 100 years, the organization wants to make sure that all people have access to health care, no matter their zip code, race, immigration status, sexual orientation, or gender identity. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. In local news, Ben Max of Gotham Gazette takes a look at the week ahead in New York politics.
There are a variety of hearings at the City Council this week, and we're waiting to see if this is the week that City Comptroller Scott Stringer releases his annual report card on how city agencies are doing in their contracting with women and minority-owned businesses. It'll either be this week or next. And Stringer's report usually stirs up a bit of attention because he's grading city agencies on a letter scale about how they are contracting with these businesses that many believe should be a more of a priority for the de Blasio administration and different city agencies. De Blasio recently made an announcement that the city is upping its goals in this area, and Stringer has been pushing the topic for some time. That being said, though, those in New York City and around the country are awaiting the third and final scheduled presidential debate, which is set for Wednesday night in Las Vegas between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But of course, here in New York, there's a variety of state and local elections that are also happening November 8th that we have to look forward to, and control of the state Senate is, of course, the key topic, whether Democrats can take control from Republicans and where the Independent Democratic Conference will fit in some sort of coalition government. While there aren't many competitive races based in New York City for the state legislature, there are many New York City interests at play and New York City forces involved in elections around the state. Speaking of the state legislature, one thing to watch for this week is that Tuesday afternoon, the New York State Commission on Legislative, Judicial, and Executive Compensation will hold a public hearing at New York University Law School. This may be the final public hearing of the commission, whose recommendations for pay raises for state officials are due by mid-November. Other events worth watching this week include a Center for an Urban Future policy symposium on the future of middle-class jobs in New York City. On Wednesday, the Center for Community and Ethnic Media at CUNY Journalism School is hosting Steve Banks, the commissioner for the New York City Human Resources Agency, which is charged with addressing the city's homelessness crisis, among other very challenging issues. And on Wednesday evening, before the presidential debate, there's a meeting of the New York City Panel for Education Policy on Staten Island. This is where the city's education policy panel votes on different aspects of city education policy and evaluates contracts and new changes to DOE policy. And Thursday, the day after the presidential debate, which is how most things will be related this week, is a busy day at the City Council with a variety of committee hearings. Also, Thursday morning, former New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn will be speaking at the Association for a Better New York. Quinn now leads Women in Need, WIN, which helps homeless women and families. One more highlight that I'll give you is on Thursday evening is the 71st annual Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation dinner held at the Waldorf Astoria, Manhattan. Presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both expected to attend. The mayor and the governor and many other current and former elected officials also usually attend the dinner. That's a brief overview of what to watch for this week in New York and national politics. For WBAI, this is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
In other news, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman was issued an arrest warrant for covering the September 3rd protest over the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. She was charged with trespassing, then the charges were changed to rioting charges. She traveled to North Dakota to face charges today. This afternoon, charges were dismissed. Amy Goodman.
It is a great honor to be here today. The judge's decision to reject the state's attorney, Ladd Erickson's, attempt to prosecute a journalist, in this case me, is a great vindication of the First Amendment and to the resistance camps to cover this epic struggle. Native people on the front lines, particularly Native American women, front lines,
and
who are taking on not only the Dakota Access Pipeline, but a global issue of climate justice, taking on the global issue of global warming. Yeah. Democracy Now! Has been covering climate justice issues for the full 20 years that we have been broadcasting. We go to every UN climate summit. So often it's indigenous people on the front lines. We covered the Keystone XL pipeline. Now we're covering the Dakota Access pipeline. And the important role of a journalist is to go to where the silence is. We should not be alone in the major media coming to cover this historic unification of Native Americans from more than 200 tribes from Latin America to the United States to Canada. All of the media should be there, given the scope of this struggle. And we encourage all of the media to come here. We certainly will continue to cover this struggle. It's not only to protect the water and land rights, but it's covering your right to speak, to be heard. We are not the only ones who have been charged. We faced misdemeanor. I faced misdemeanors. But I know there are a number of people who are going to court even as we speak here. Also important to point out other journalists who are being arrested.
Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman said the state's attorney was attempting to stop journalism. In other environmental news, New York City's public employee unions are considering pushing to have their pension funds divest from fossil fuel industries. Andrea Sears reports.
The five pension funds total about $170 billion, with more than $7 billion invested in fossil fuel. Last year, Mayor Bill de Blasio proposed taking pension fund money out of coal and studying the climate impact of other investments. According to Mark Dunley from the group 350 NYC, since the divestment movement began less than 4 years ago, investors around the world have withdrawn about $5 trillion from those industries.
But we don't have that many governments doing it so far, and it would be really great to see New York City take the lead, especially since New York City is one of the cities most at risk to climate change.
On Saturday, union leaders and members got an update on an evaluation now in progress of the pension fund's carbon footprint. That study is expected to be completed early next year. Dunley says divestment was first raised as a moral issue, as some feel the city shouldn't invest in industries that put it at risk of rising sea levels. But it turns out to have been sound investment advice on a purely financial level, too.
If they had divested when we asked 3.5 years ago and invested the money in other parts of the stock market, we'd have about $5 billion more than we presently have.
And Dunley points out that the loss of value in fossil fuel industries has accelerated since the Paris Climate Agreement to keep global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius in this century.
The world has said we have to stop using fossil fuels as rapidly as we possibly can. And if you are invested in fossil fuels, you do not have a future economic viability plan.
350 is a grassroots network of campaigns to curb climate change. Today, 350 International is relaunching its efforts to promote divestment from fossil fuels, making divestment in New York City and state priorities for the coming year. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
In other environmental news, it took 7 years and $13 million, but environmentalists, trade justice activists, and the people of El Salvador got a big victory this Friday, Ken Gale reports.
It's a victory which gives environmentalists hope. In 2009, the Pacific Rim Mining Corporation announced plans to mine gold in El Salvador. The cyanide they used in gold mining would have poisoned the Rio Lempa watershed, which provides drinking water for a majority of the people in the country, not to mention their farms and wildlife. When the nation said no, the mining company sued under the Central America Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, for $250 million for what they call future lost profits. They can do that under CAFTA and NAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if passed, will make more corporations able to sue for still more reasons. Affected communities do not have the legal right to participate in the lawsuit, and in El Salvador, four community organizers who were active in the struggle against mining were murdered. Marcelo Romero, Dora Alicia Racino Sordo, Ramiro Rivera, and Juan Francisco Duran Ayala. Since the World Bank Tribunal almost always rules in favor of corporations, it looked bad. The Economist magazine described it as a secretive tribunal of highly paid corporate lawyers. But the tribunal ruled in favor of El Salvador. This is great news with far-reaching consequences. that the secret international tribunal would rule for people over profit, that the tribunal would rule in favor of protecting a country's drinking water supply over a company's future profit, that CAFTA, NAFTA, and maybe the TPP may not be as all-powerful as the corporations want it to be. This is another win for the environment. And the environment is not some abstract thing. It's the air we breathe and the water we drink and crop irrigation quality. And all this affects our health and health costs. Expect corporate and environmental lawyers to study this case for a long time to come. The corporations don't want to lose again. And environmental lawyers hope to use the arguments here to win again. Ken Gale, WBAI News, New York.
In other news, 63-year-old Vanita Browder, the mother of Khalif Browder, has passed away. She was surrounded by five of her six surviving children. Her lawyer yesterday said she suffered a heart attack. The New York City community mourns her passing. She experienced extreme hardship over the suicide death of her son, Khalif, who was held in solitary at Rikers as a child. His death focused attention on Rikers. His brother, Akeem, is active in work to shut down Rikers. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, October 17th, 2016. The news was produced with Ben Max, Ken Gale, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.